So because I'm so poor at admin, I have to be amazing at it because that's the only way to end up good enough at it.
Chris Mead is an improviser, writer and creative who focuses on emotionally connected, relationship-driven improv. He is lucky enough to teach and perform all over the world. Chris studied theatre at the prestigious Royal Holloway College and continues to explore improv with every school, theatre and practitioner he can find. Me and Chris talks about making an impact in the scene, to do what feels true and allow yourself to just be on stage. We talk about making deliberate choices for the show, the importance of feeling safe and having a second brain. We are also talking about GDT systems, cafe factories, and journeymans. This is episode 69 with Chris Mead on Impro as Not Only Comedic.
I guess what I'm thinking about at the moment is that improv isn't just a comedic thing.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that it's also great for kind of beautiful theatrical grounded relationship work, and just, yeah, that's something I've been thinking about a lot.
Yeah,
like, is improv good for anything other than just making people laugh?
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting topic. Let's just jump from that and see wherever it takes us.
That was great,
because it's like incorporated in the improv of doing mistakes, and so even though you're trying to be very dramatic, the mistakes will occur, and then it's hard that it won't be comedic.
Yes.
But you're meaning like for the purpose, have you done like dramatic improv for the purpose?
Yeah, most of the stuff I do now is more, I would say, theatrical.
Theatrical, yeah. What's the difference?
Theatrical, like, just wants to, like, yeah. Theatrical, you know, you're thinking about the show. You're like really crafting every element of it. You're not doing something because that's the way other improv teams do it. Probably people come to improv from sketch, and they come from stand-up, and they come from just because people tell them they're the funniest person in the room. And then other people come because they're actors. And I think a lot of the most famous improv leans towards, well, this is a sketch show, really. The final result is mostly like a sketch show. I want my shows to be mostly like a work of theatre. I want them to be like play. But plays can be funny.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's, I think, the difference.
But is it like, is it leaning towards acting?
Yeah. So people come into my improv classes and go, I'm not an actor, I'm an improviser. And I'm sort of like, tough. No, you are an actor. Every improviser is an actor. Yeah. And I think people, they don't want to do that because people don't want to commit to the emotion of a scene. Right. They want to be really glib. Oh, you shot me. That's bad, isn't it? Oh, that's an inconvenience. I want people to feel stuff, and I want there to be consequences. And when someone says something hurtful or delightful, then I want it to land with the other person. Otherwise, I feel robbed as an audience member. I feel like I'm skimming along the surface of the scene. I think it makes it funnier as well.
Exactly. It's a lot of more like I'm just showing what I'm supposed to feel here instead of, you can still show, but show in the sense of that I show for real. I do it for real.
Yes, the difference between showing and telling.
Yeah.
So there's a scene.
Yeah, exactly.
You could have a couple that go, oh, we're always frustrated with each other, aren't we? Yes, we're always frustrated. That, I feel, is nowhere near as good as showing a scene where both actors show that they're frustrated with each other. They never go, you know what? The emotion that we're emoting here is frustration.
Right.
Just to tell the audience, it's just like, how can you just show that?
Yeah.
And I think that's so much more interesting to watch. It feels so much more confident and more. And I often say that if you rely on your brain in improv to supply you with clever lines or funny situations, however brilliant you are, and there are brilliant people in our art form, at some point your brain's going to stop supplying you with great stuff. But we can always feel, we can always decide on an emotional point of view. That well never dries up. You can always come back to it. So if you root your improv in relationship and emotion, and then know that the funny, clever, interesting things will be sprinkled on top, but know that that's not the root of what you're trying to do, then I think that's, for me, I'm much more confident about coming on stage, knowing that all I'm going to do is create a relationship with the people I'm there and trust that the funny is there, not, oh, I've got to think of loads of funny, clever things now. That makes me, mad. I can't do it.
Right. But we are talking about like being in your head and thinking of stuff instead of feel it and be in it, in a sense. And so, because like the funny side of it doesn't have to contradict the theatrical aspect.
Absolutely not.
Right?
Yeah.
You said that it's rather increasing the funniness, and I totally agree. And we talked a little bit, just a quick chat before we started to record that, because I'm doing the FA intensive.
Yeah.
And what I think, because I was in the States this summer doing the IO intensive as well.
Great, yeah. One of the cons.
And what I think is like the different is that the FA so far anyway this week is really talking about commitment to the emotions and to the relationship, and then we will stumble on the funny thing and we will play with that. And we haven't really got into premises, because then we had to think of what's funny and so. But so far, I mean, like they really stress the importance of doing it for real. Don't just giggle it away, or like if you do get shot, you get shot. Like if your friend gets shot, he gets shot.
Yeah, how would you react? How would your character
react? And then do like the mapping thing of it. It might not be a person, it might be a mosquito that you have slapped, but you still have the same like emotional reaction to it as if it was your friend.
Yeah, but it's rooted in truthful reaction.
Right?
Yes.
Right.
And that's what makes it funny. Because the laughs we get in improv are not the same laughs that you get in stand-up. So I'm sure every improviser has had this situation where you say you do improv and someone says, tell me a joke, or so you're really funny then. And it's like, no, that isn't what improv is. The laughs we get are laughs of recognition, of delight, of connection. It's like, oh, I see what's happening there. It's not, oh, you've done some brilliant wordplay, or you made a brilliant plot move. Very rarely is that where you get the audience reaction. Mostly it's just you do something that feels true.
Right.
And so the best thing you can do as an improviser is allow yourself to be you on stage. And normally it takes years, because we become performative when we step on stage. We put layers of artifice between us and the audience. And I think great improv is slowly moving to peeling those away, so that you are vulnerable and authentic on stage. And then it is funny. It's glorious. And you see both sides of what the improv scene is. You see the character and world that you're presenting, but you also see the improvisers who are working together to create that world. And that can be breathtakingly beautiful to watch the way that the players create the scene. And as an audience member, you are actually clocking both of those things at the same time, both puppet and puppeteer at the same time. And a really skilled improviser can emphasize one aspect or another. Like now, and not to a point where it becomes a meta commentary scene, but like you see both sides of it, both these two friends who love being in each other's company, creating beautiful art, but also the nuts and bolts of the scene itself. And both of them are important, and both of them are part of the performance.
Yeah, it's two shows at the same time, right? What do you mean with like emphasize, a skillful improviser can emphasize like what the show needs right now? Now the audience might know that they're improvisers.
They might smile or something. And for a moment, you absolutely see those two improvisers on stage having a whale of a time making the scene. And other times they will just turn completely the other way and you'll just be interested in the actual characters and the situation and not see any of the artifice around it. And I love a performer that's able to do both of those things. So like move between them as the scene demands, as the energy in the room demands. Yeah. You don't want to continually be winking at the audience,
right?
But you also don't want to just never do it.
Why not?
Because I think that's one of the wonderful things about improv, that you get to see it. It's not a polished theatrical production. It can be incredibly skillful, but always there's always that sense of this could all go wrong. This could all fall apart at any moment. And I think if you get so practiced and so polished at improv, and there are a few groups in the UK who are just so good now that sense of danger of sort of the vertiginous excitement of, are they going to pull this off? They're so good now that that's gone. And it's still great to watch. But the stuff I really love is someone that's 3 or 4 years in and it could just fall apart. And you see it nearly fall apart.
Yeah.
And then they rescue it in some amazing way and it comes back. That, I think, is so much more interesting to me personally, where I am at the moment. So I never want to get so good that the improviser completely disappears from the show.
Right. But if you do get that good, why not like making it harder in the scene? So we are always like balancing.
Exactly. If you get the good, don't coast on it. Like find new ways, like push yourself somehow. Find harder formats, you know, create new shows, work with new people. Yeah. That's how you're going to grow. Don't just stay doing that beautiful thing that you know is 95% going to work, because you're not going to get any better from that point.
Right. It's like creating these structures and tools or rules or whatever you want to call them, and then knowing them and then keeping it to your, like doing it all the time. It gets boring as well. Like you want the variation and you want the challenge in it as well.
Yeah. So I always think of there's a group in Austin, Texas, out of the Hideout Theatre called Parallelogramophonograph, or P-Graph for short. They are now a four-person narrative team, and they, I don't think they do it as much anymore, but they change their format every time that they get good at it. So they are, for my money, the best narrative team I've ever seen, and they did a French farce show, a show based on that sort of discipline of French farce. And then when they got really good at it, they could have gone touring just doing that show, but they're like, now we're going to do a Dickens show, or now we're going to do a sci-fi show in the style of Event Horizon or Solaris, where things slowly go wrong to forces outside the ship are beginning to act on and they're kind of supernatural. They'll choose a new thing each time. Someone pointed out within the group once that their villains weren't particularly evil or felt very 2D. So they did a whole show called Villainy, where they just played villains until they got great at it. And then they folded those skills back into their other shows. So that's the thing for me. I'm never going to get a format and be like, this is great, we can do this, and then not create new things. There's always a way to push yourself. And if I can be in a class and look to my right and Patty Styles is there with a notebook making notes, then, you know, if Patty Styles still feels there's new things that she can learn and new avenues she can pursue, then there's no excuse for anyone working in improv today to not be continuing to learn and grow.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But with the theater aspect of it, why do you think that improviser? Because we do have this when we're speaking about like American improv anyway, and in Sweden we also have like house team, and and team is the concept of
not
the group.
Not company
nor ensemble, nor actors. It's improvisers, comedians more towards that. And right now, in my personal opinion, I'm leaning towards more like I want improv to be fun. But I don't want it to be not real.
Yes. Right. So this is why I use theatrical, not dramatic. Because I think dramatic means like melancholy or big emotions and po-faced. I don't want that. I still want it to be light on its feet and fun and playful. But I also don't want it to not, I don't want it to not mean anything. I want it to have weight. I do think of it as an art form. I wouldn't do it otherwise. And I think so many people think of improv as that kind of throwaway thing you do above a pub. Like, you know, short form games, any version of improv can be weighty and interesting. But I just, you know, that kind of really surface stuff, I don't want. I think my stuff is, the things that I'm in is really playful, but we also think of it as a proper show. We think about costumes, we think about set, we think about lighting, we think about music. We don't run on as ourselves at the beginning and introduce ourselves if the show doesn't demand that, just because there's a convention in improv that people run on at the beginning with high energy music and, you know, do a slightly awkward dance, and then one person steps forwards and says, hi, we're whatever the name of your team is, and we're going to do this form for you tonight. And to get us started, all we need is this one word. I don't think that's the right way for every show to start. And so if I'm going to do a gothic fairy story, then maybe I'm going to start in darkness and one person creeps into a spotlight and talk and like introduce the show in character in a narrator voice, or, you know, what is appropriate for this show. If I'm doing a sci-fi show, maybe we pre-recorded a projection of the ship's computer welcoming you to the show and asking for the suggestion. Like, how can we do that stuff is what I'm thinking about. That's what I mean by theatrical, this idea that we're welcoming people into a world. I don't want to dress in, well, I mean, I'm dressed in a hoodie today, but I don't want to come in jeans and a hoodie every time if that's not the appropriate thing for the show. Yeah. And because my background's in theatre, because I studied theatre to degree, you know, that's what my degree's in, and I love theatre. I just feel like there's scripted theatre and there's improvised theatre, and they're both on the same level. They just have, you know, they have different focuses. And every time we go, I'm not an actor, or don't commit to the obvious emotional stakes within the scene, then we're sort of letting it down a bit.
So do you think that's only because of the convention and people's, assumption about what it is supposed, or why don't improvisers accept that we are also actors? And
yeah, I think it's a convention thing. I coach a lot of teams, so, you know, I sort of go into other, and I'll always ask, like, why are you starting it like that? And it often is just because that's how they've seen other groups start it. And if it's right, if you think coming on high energy and dancing and then introducing your show is absolutely the right thing, if you made that as a conscious decision,
yeah,
I'm all for it.
Yeah, right.
But if you can't tell me why you're doing any aspect of your show, then you need to think about it a little bit more.
Yeah.
You might come to the conclusion that you are dead right, but let's have that conversation, I think.
Right. So exactly, like thinking of why you choose to go up on the stage in that sense. It might fit or it might not.
Yeah.
But it's...
make it conscious.
Yeah, make it conscious.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Chris, what... it feels that you are a person that has been in a lot of different improv ponds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I only took a workshop with you in Amsterdam last year, and I know it was like few people there, and they were going to Amsterdam Festival only because you were their main coach, and they didn't want to miss out an opportunity to get coached by you.
It was very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, that says something about you as a teacher, like how committed you're pupils or students are,
yeah,
to you as a coach, and that you are very appreciated.
Yeah, I don't really know what my strengths are as a teacher, except that I care about this stuff and I've dedicated my life to it. So I'm by no means, you know, the best improviser in the UK. I'm nowhere near, but I am someone who is working consistently at the art form, yeah, and I've got to a point now where I make that my life's work.
Mm.
So I don't have another job. I don't do commercials, I don't do stand-up or script. I just work on this,
yeah,
and I do it enough that I can make my living doing that. I don't like the culture of, I definitely don't like the word guru, because I think that's from a certain culture and it feels a little bit, bad that we're sort of taking that. But that idea of I'm a master,
mm,
and I am, and I'm here to teach you, hate that. I love the word journeyman. I like these, you know, these sort of craftsmen that just keep working at their crafts their whole life, okay, and they get good at it.
Yeah.
But there's always more to learn and always more to do. I want to be a journeyman improviser. I want to be someone who is just constantly engaged and interested in the craft. And I think that's possibly the reason that people keep coming to me, because I'm never going to take it for granted that you're giving up time to be in my class. I want to prepare really well. I want to give good notes afterwards. I want to keep in touch and support you in your improv journey afterwards. I genuinely do, because people took the time to do that for me and continue to, because I still go to classes, of course, because there's so much to learn. And I just want to do that too, because improv has given me so much. I just wrote about this, so it's really on the top of my mind.
Cool, cool.
But this idea that improv gave me a way to express myself creatively, even when I just had a normal office job, it let the theatrical creative part of me have an outlet in the evenings in a way that didn't ask too much of me. It introduced me to a new social group. I have hundreds of people that I know well now all over the world. If I can go to any major European city and have someone I know there immediately, and that's the same for all improvisers. It's just like it gives you a community of practice. People are all doing the same thing, and also I think it makes me a better human being. I feel more relaxed, more capable, more confident in the face of the unexpected. I feel like I'm a better listener. I feel I'm more empathetic, kinder than I used to be. And it's because I train in improv, and because, going back to the community, because they all train in improv too, they are kind, thoughtful people who want the best as well. So improv has given me all of these things. So I am evangelical about improv. I love it. I want to share that with everyone else. So yeah, however skillful I am, pedagogically speaking, as a teacher, I think the thing that I have is, like, I really like it, and that means that people were prepared to kind of come to my classes more than once, even if they've already learned the skills, because it just feels like an environment. Well, yeah, and the other thing is something that I really didn't do very well to begin with, but just like, how do you keep people feeling safe? Like, how do you set up your classroom where people feel that they can be brave enough to like really do improv? And I used to think that was just me going, this is a safe space. Mm. And by the magical qualities of my voice, I would be able to create a safe space just by saying so. Now I understand, and this is definitely through me taking classes with people like Stephen Davidson and Monica Gaga and Rama Nicholas, who really specialize in, like, how can we do stuff that is more intimate and still feel completely safe doing it.
Mm.
Because, so Rama is an intimacy coordinator in TV and film as well. There is also Lucy Fennell, who's in the UK, who does a lot of this stuff brilliantly as well. But this idea of, like, at least with a script, if you're doing a love scene or something, you know what's going to happen. In improv, you don't. So how do you, and this is a very specific case, but how do you create those that environment where you can be intimate and still keep yourself safe? And that's one aspect of it. How can you know where people's lines are in terms of their identity, in terms of their sexuality or their race or their gender identity, any disabilities they might have or neurodiversities, their religion? These are all who people are. They need to be respected and cared for and held in some way. To take the time every class to be like, how do you come to improv today? How's your body? How's your brain? How are you feeling? Is there anything that you just aren't prepared to engage with today? What can we do as a class, as a cast, as a company, as an ensemble to make sure that you feel as safe as you possibly can? That's good work. But it feels, even me hearing me say it now, it feels so worthy. But it's important. When I started improv at the beginning of 2000s, like, I was like, this is a community that I feel completely welcome in and I feel so safe. But I was a straight, white, cisgendered man. And that's why I felt safe. There was no other guidelines or things to help people who had any kind of minority voice or weren't that kind of dominant in any of those spectrums, they, you know, I don't think they felt safe. They didn't feel like they were an accepted part of the group. We have, so I'm talking a lot, but this idea of group mind in improv, which is like, can we find a place where we're all, where, you know, the group has speaks with one voice, with one set of values. That's often just the people who are shouting the loudest and there's the most of, and everyone else just sort of shuts up. That's what group mind can be in its worst sense. The best kind of group mind is where every single voice is equally treated, and that takes a lot more time and care and attention than we were prepared to lavish on it to begin with. I'm still terrible at it. It feels so clunky. I feel like I have to stop a class at the top and be like, right, what? How are we feeling this week? Is there anything we can't do? And be constantly on, and then it makes people think that they're going to hurt each other because we're talking about it more. But my experience is that by the end of our time together, when we've really engaged in those topics, the scenes that you're able to do together are richer, yeah, more diverse, more interesting, and you can actually go farther. I think a really quick example of that, if you say out loud, there is no kissing on the mouth in this class, then the scenes that you can do intimacy-wise will be much more intimate than if you don't say that, because you know you're never going to kiss.
Yeah.
You're happy to lean into that person
mm.
because you know that line's never going to be crossed. And so the stuff that you are able to do is so much better. And actually, people who are together, it's not like they're constantly necking. Like they just touch each other, they hold each other's hand, they pick a speck of dust off their shoulder, they run their hand down their back.
Right.
It's these little things that say we're together.
Yeah.
There's so much before it comes to smushing faces together.
Definitely.
And so when you draw those lines, you can explore all of that.
Yeah.
And you really notice when people are couples on stage and they do not touch, that they keep a distance from each other and then maybe lunge at each other as the lights
mm.
go off. That's not a relationship.
Mm.
And so I'm super interested in how do we keep each other safe? And you can't say this is a safe space. You can strive for an open, honest space. It's the best you can do as a teacher, I think.
Yeah. Strive for an open, honest space. So if I got you, I'm trying to like conclude what you said, that like because it's I also teach, and it's like it takes, of course, in Sweden we have like 2 hours,
yes, exactly,
50 minutes break or so, and then I also do like I say it's a space for everyone that they can share their needs in, like any special needs they have today or so, like feel a space to feel,
yeah, I love it,
yeah. And to create the safetiness in a way, but I'm also struggling with it. It's hard. And I really agree with the thing that you said in the early 20s.
Early 2000s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That like it's still, of course, that in Sweden as well. And I also, as cis man, feel very welcomed in the community. But how is it possible to, without like taking too much time, that
yes.
It's limited, right?
Yeah.
But
if it's like 8 weeks, if you're teaching 8 to 10 weeks, then it's worth taking half an hour at the beginning of your first class to say this, because you're going to do better improv later on because of it.
Yeah. And also, as I said, yeah, the boundaries that you keep, that like we won't kiss this course, that makes you easier for people to like grasp hands and to lean into each other.
Yeah.
And it's also about the theatrical aspect of it. Because one, if you don't like, if you tell instead of showing, as we mentioned in the beginning, it's maybe you don't like, because then you don't grasp hands even or like hug each other in the scene, because you just tell, I love you, Annie, or like, oh, I wish I could hug you now, or I don't know, instead of actually hugging, because then you also get this intimacy, right?
There's a huge difference between a scene starting and someone coming on stage and going, oh, I've had a hard day, honey.
Yeah.
You know, I bet when you married me, you didn't think I'd be such a grump all the time.
Mm.
And just have someone come in, take off their coat, just snuggle down next to them, grab their arm and lean their head on the other person's shoulder. That says everything. And it's somewhat much more elegant and confident and theatrical. Let me use that word again. But you've got to do the work over and over again to feel like you can come in and do that with another improviser. Take their space. You need to know that you aren't like freaking them out, because people have such different boundaries, and we have different boundaries week to week as well.
Right.
That's why I will always do a quick check-in every week. And this is, again, something I learned from Steve and Monica. It changes week on week.
Yeah.
The way you are in your body.
Yeah.
The way you're in brain. My wife at the moment is dealing with quite severe social anxiety and depression. She can wake up a different person each day.
Mm.
Some days she wakes up and she's just to the person that I know completely, and we'll just get out of bed and do things. Somebody, she wakes up and she just can't get out of bed.
Mm.
I mean, that's an extreme example, but we all do that. Some days we can cope with going really deep with that improv. Sometimes we just want to be two penguins who are best friends on an ice floe and just be like, that's all you can cope with some weeks.
Yeah.
You need to have an outlet to be able to say those things. Otherwise, you're going to get driven away from improv. And I have to say, in my darkest moments, I think about the people who did leave my classes because I wasn't looking after that enough. Like maybe another student said something to them, or they didn't feel welcomed, or, you know, all of the scenes were about stuff that wasn't part of their culture or wasn't part of their experience or interest, to a point where they were just like, no, I'm not going to do improv anymore.
Mm.
How many people walked away and never said anything?
Mm.
I don't want to be a person that does that. And so to bring it back to how this all started, I'm so pleased when someone will retake class with me or travel to a different country to take class with me, because it means that they feel that I have created a space where they can learn and be safe and be an artist.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's sort of what I want.
Yeah. Yeah, the importance of checking also every time. I'm thinking, meanwhile, like, how is it in my group? How is it when I'm teaching?
Yeah.
Is it enough to just leave space for, like, I don't know, 10 seconds silence?
Well, I'll tell you what I put in. And this, again, we have to keep shouting out Stephen Davidson and Monica Gaga, because so much of my journey came in this area, came from taking multiple classes with them during the pandemic. Just this idea of, number one, here are the physical boundaries.
Mm.
We're not going to kiss each other. Mm. We are not going to touch each other in any area that would be called like a bikini or swimsuit area. Mm. That they're physical ones.
Yeah.
If you're a glasses wearer, no one's going to take your glasses off, even, you know, as a joke. Yeah. That's how you see. That's not going to happen.
That's a good example.
Yeah. Mm. And then mental boundaries are, we're not going to do gory violence where there's real kind of consequences to that violence. Like, there's obviously a place for kind of really cartoony violence, as long as we know how to do that, but we're not going to do visceral bloody violence, and that we're not going to do kind of objectifying sexual acts. We're certainly not going to mimic anything or do anything like that. And the most important one is that someone's identity is theirs, and it's not something to A, be questioned, or B, be laughed at. We're not going to punch down on people.
Mm.
Just because comedy has used making fun of people with less social cachet or less voice, you know, has made a career comedy of making fun of those people for centuries, doesn't mean that we have to continue to do that.
Mm.
And so no punching down. Maybe a bit of punching up. I'm happy for people to make fun of the government. But so those are the ones that are in place, overarching. And then what else have people got each week? You know, what else do you want to add to that?
Yeah.
You can sign if you're really working with people for a long time, make a cast charter, a team charter. These are the things, and they get everyone to add to it and maintain it in a Google document that anyone can access. And then you know, right?
Mm.
And the final thing is, you know, make sure that there's a way that someone can stop a scene.
Mm.
Like have a mechanism,
of course,
timeout mechanism,
yeah,
of some kind.
Yeah.
And get people to practice it.
Yeah. I think it's, I take a lot with me from this in that sense. I'd ask you to ask, how do you cope as a full-time working improviser then? Because you do performances and you teach, and you probably do your weekly letters.
Yeah.
Is it weekly?
It is, yeah, every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday, yeah. And so also like the, I don't know, the administrative, like, because I'm struggling with these three as well. Like, how should I divide them and where is my main focus? And it's so much on like the administrative part of it.
I had to get really good at having a system in place, because I am that kind of stereotypical creative that if I don't have a system, things get lost. So I have a bunch of things. I actually base a lot on the GTD Get Things Done system, which is where you have a what's called a second brain, which is a giant branching to-do list throughout all your projects, and you don't put personal and work to-do lists separately. They're all together. They're all in a big project list. Every project has a task, which is the next available thing that you can do. What's the next thing that you actually are able to do right now? I update that every week, keep it up to date so I know that everything's in there. And every morning, I'll look down those lists and I'll be like, and take things from different projects so I'm moving more than one thing forwards at any one time. I maintain a zero inbox, so I always reduce it back to zero or place them in another folder if it's something I've got to deal with or reply to it immediately. So I have all of that. They all cross-reference with each other. My calendar will tell me where I've got to be, and then I maintain a huge list of improv exercises and lesson plans in a software program called Notion, which allows me to, so there's a big database of exercises, and you can plug those exercises into a template framework for lessons. And then those lessons, you click a button, they can go online, so you can then share them with your students afterwards. And then and that all connects to each other. And then, of course, those can become sort of, obviously each lesson is slightly different, but you can kind of refer back to them and be like, oh, you know, I remember 3 years ago I did a course about emotional connection. What did I do then? What do I want to update? But, you know, you have a kind of basis, so you're not reinventing the wheel every time you start teaching it something new. I've got to keep all of those things up, maintaining a current to-do list. The idea of a second brain is that if you have everything in there, your brain can finally stop worrying that it's forgotten about something. Because most of us are in a constant state of, there's something that I haven't done. What's that thing I haven't done? But if you are rigorous with keeping your second brain up to date, then that voice does quieten down and you know you've got everything there. So because I'm so poor at admin, I have to be amazing at it because that's the only way to end up good enough at it. So I put a lot of time into that. There's also a danger that you get so excited by systems that you spend all your time maintaining your systems and no time doing it.
Right.
So one of these things about GTD is that in the old days, there were workers and there were managers. So they use the analogy of a factory which makes cakes, and the cakes come down the line, and you put a cherry on top as the worker, and then you put another cherry on top of the next one. And that's what you do with your day. It's boring, but you know exactly what you're doing.
Mm.
And the manager of the factory needs to make sure the cakes coming on the line need to order all the ingredients, must heat the factory, organize payroll, and do all of that. But they're two separate things, the managerial role and the worker role.
Mm.
When you're a freelancer, you are both of those things at once. Yeah. But you can't do them at the same time. You've got to spend time as a manager.
Mm.
And then the glorious thing is, you get, once you've organized yourself as a manager, you get to put the cherries on the cakes.
Yeah.
And it's easy, and you know exactly what you're doing.
Yeah.
So you've got to spend time as a manager, but then you've got to spend time putting the cherries on cakes, which for us is putting lesson plans together and then going out and doing those classes and responding to emails.
Right.
Or talking with students and helping them and stuff.
Yeah, it's a great analogy, I think.
Yeah.
And also like, so you just take time to do, now I'm doing this, or I clump it together, these practical things that I have to do. Also emails, for instance, like, I'm doing this for an hour now, and then I do that for an hour, and then I would do the sherry.
Yes, exactly.
And then when I'm going to teach or perform or whatever.
And the other thing is cultivating good habits.
Yeah.
So there's I think it was the best-selling book on Amazon last year. So it's not, I'm not telling people one they don't know, but Atomic Habits by James Clear tells you how to create more good habits. Because a habit is something you do automatically, right? Something that you do habitually. Who you are is the things that you do. So if you cultivate more good habits than bad habits, then you will be a better, more productive person. And yeah. If you just have more bad habits, if your habits become, I'm going to veg out on the sofa every day and watch the whole way through, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, then you're not going to do that stuff. So yeah, cultivate even like going for a run or eating healthily, they're habits.
Mm.
And so that book, Atomic Habits, was the thing that changed the way I was as an improviser more than anything else.
And I think that to be able to work as an improviser, you need to really to do be the manager as well, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, you have to. Yeah, you have to be both.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Like for now, anyway. Like I don't know. In the future, maybe like you can have it that big.
You could have an employee that does that stuff for you if you get really big. But I can't imagine you'd ever make that much money from improv. So my top three would be connect with the other person. You're not even looking at them. You know, come on stage and actually. The only thing that's real in the scene is the person you're playing it with, the plot, the scene, the kind of the set, everything else that's not real. So connect with that person.
Mm.
That would be number one. Number two would be, this is fun, be playful. If you're not enjoying this scene, don't do it. Like follow your bliss, go to something that's exciting and interesting. And three would be like, make the other person look good. It's something that we say all the time to beginners, but sometimes we don't spend the time working out how to do that well. So like, make the other person look good. Like, if you know they're a brilliant singer, find ways for them to sing. If you know they're great at you know, character work, give them an interesting character to be. Spend your time elevating their work is the best thing to do, I would say. So they would be my three tips. And an improv nugget, I mean, I think what I've said before, if I can repeat it, which is like, never stop learning.
Mm.
Always, you know, there's always something new you can get excited about in improv. It's such a broad art form.
Yeah. And that's inspiring to hear you that have done improv so long, like still do that, like, and the failure one, like doing it.
Yeah.
Keep learning, like you can always learn new stuff.
And do not be... prideful about it.
Right.
Someone who's been doing it for a couple of years still has stuff to teach you.
Yeah.
Because they're creating new stuff all the time.
Yeah.
Don't be like, I'm above this. Never, ever be like that.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Amazing. Thank you. Hooray.